The five biggest stories.
I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story.
Five opinions.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yada, yada, yada.
Each and every week.
That would be great.
This is the Intersection Podcast with Jason Page.
Fantastic.
Here's Jason.
Thank you so much, Chad Erickson. Thanks for being with us on this bonus episode of the Intersection Podcast. If you listened to our episode that came before this one, you may have heard a small portion of an interview I conducted with 2017 Nobel Peace Prize winner Beatrice Finn. She is the executive director with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. I recently had the opportunity to have an extended conversation with this true global leader when it comes to the dialogue of denuclearization. Due to a lot of requests that we had after playing this initial piece of our conversation, I decided to post the entire interview into its own podcast. So here they are, the thoughts of ICANN Executive Director Beatrice Finn.
And now, the Intersection Interview.
In the overall scheme of things, of all the things we're talking about in the world right now, post-Donald Trump in the U.S., where I just moved here from, here in Singapore, we're talking about COVID, we're talking about all these different issues. It feels like, in some regards, the issue of nuclear proliferation kind of gets put on the back burner. And I know Tony Blinken and the State Department are doing some things, but I grew up on the back end of the Cold War. Okay, I'm 43. I'm a little older than you, but I grew up on the back end of the Cold War. So I had a little understanding of the idea that the United States and then the Soviet Union had nuclear arsenals. Never felt like there was a threat of them being used, though. Then you have the fall of the Berlin Wall, Cold War, history lesson and all that, basically over a couple of years later. You had an organization dedicated to the elimination of nuclear weapons. But I sometimes wonder how many people view this topic of nuclear proliferation when Hiroshima is so far back in the history books in the 40s. I mean, hell, 9/11 is 25 or whatever, 20 years old. I mean, there's kids growing up today that don't even know anything of 9/11, let alone Hiroshima. It feels like in a world that's constantly moving from crisis to crisis and doesn't linger much on anything, how difficult does that make your mission more of a challenge from the standpoint of trying to get the everyday person to take the threat seriously?
I mean, that's really hitting the straight to the key issue here and the key problem of nuclear weapons. It is difficult, right? Because, and I think it's not so much about the topic in itself only, it's also human nature, right? We're really bad at thinking about sort of preventing things in advance. And it's really easy to postpone that kind of work until it happens. And I think we've seen that a little bit with the pandemic now, or even climate change. I work here in Geneva. I have a lot of friends who work at the World Health Organization. And before this work, I was also involved a little bit in preventing bioweapons. So I've talked a lot to these kind of health researchers and experts that work on WHO and pandemics. And they've been saying for decades, a pandemic is coming, right? Like they have said that many, many times. The WHO has said it many times. Yet we're taken completely off guard.
The Obama administration. The Obama administration had said it was coming. Yeah. Even several years ago.
Even we saw it in starting in China, and then still like, no, it's not going to come here. It's like human nature is really bad at kind of dealing with things before it's a crisis. But there are certain issues. Pandemics, of course, we're seeing now. Climate change, and I think in particular nuclear war, that is just, you cannot deal with it afterwards. And I think the same thing, like the huge kind of movement against climate change really ignited a couple of years ago when it got hotter, when people felt it. The problem with nuclear weapons is, though, when you feel it, it's too late. So it's like a non-issue until it's the only issue.
Isn't that human nature, though? Isn't it human nature that nobody reacts to anything? When does somebody generally care about gun violence? When it impacts them? When does somebody care about drunk driving? Mothers against drunk driving. When do people care? When one of their loved ones gets killed by a drunk driver. I had a friend get killed by a drunk driver 3 years ago. None of us ever cared about drunk driving. One of your friends gets killed. Now, all of a sudden, it's your cause celeb. And you can go on and on in that matter.
Yeah, but I think... Yeah, and I would say that relates to, we can deal with the issues when we connect with it, right? When we understand it on a human level, and not just the facts, but when we connect it. It doesn't have to happen to ourselves, but we need to see, we need to kind of visualize it, and we need to feel something for it. So really what we've been trying to do is really start kind of over. The conversation around non-proliferation and nuclear disarmament has for long been very focused on the technical stuff, number of warheads, strategic stability between the United States and Russia. It's power games between Putin and Kim Jong-un and Modi and Netanyahu and all of these kind of, you know, actors. And what we're trying to do in order to connect with people is to really look at it first, you know, from a human level, look at the impact of nuclear weapons, like not the strategic numbers game of warheads and missiles, but what does radiation do to people? What are the targets of these things? What happened long term? We're also looking at things like nuclear testing, for example, that it's not just Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's been over 2,000 tests of nuclear weapons with devastating impact on indigenous communities, former colonies, for example. And I think that ties together very much with this conversation that we're having now globally about racism. Which policies protect us? Who is in charge of protecting us, and who does that actually protect? Because nuclear weapons is seen as this kind of security guarantee, but mainly for the people in power, not from for the communities in Nevada or New Mexico, for example, where nuclear weapons were used or tested, or not in Marshall Islands. Not in Algeria, where the French government tested, not in the Pacific Islands, where the French and the British tested. So there's this kind of idea that, you know, there, it is actually ongoing harm. And then, you know, we're also trying to connect to people with looking at things like, you know, how do you see security? What protects you? And I think that this is a, you know, a perfect example now during a pandemic. Like the United States spends like $35 billion a year on nuclear weapons. It can't pay $2,000 to people that have lost their jobs and have no source of income because of shutdowns, right? Like, so, and you know, you don't have healthcare, but there's like blank checks to the weapons companies in even the COVID relief package. There was more money going to the weapons companies than went to the American people. So, you know, again, like who protects who and who makes the decision on what security is? Maybe it's not the military that protects us. Maybe it's the nurses and the delivery people at the moment that are actually keeping us safe and alive these days. So I think, you know, in a way, our the way that we can kind of get people to think about this issue, I think, is to broaden it a little bit as well and not talk too much about the number of warheads, right, and the technical stuff, but to really kind of connect this to broader movements of economic justice, of healthcare, of budgetary kind of conversations, about human security, like what protects people, about gender equality, anti-racism. And so we're trying to connect this like to a bigger issue so that people don't have to prioritize just this, but can, it can be a part of a like a number of issues that we're pushing.
How difficult have you found it to break through to that younger audience that is so invested in those other causes? How hard is it to push this one? You know, because let's be honest, people only have so much bandwidth. You know what I mean? Mm. So in that regard, how difficult is that for you?
I think it's, I mean, it's definitely a challenge. I think that it's, but it's definitely possible. You just have to do it in an honest way. I think one of the good things about this issue is that almost everyone knows what a nuclear weapon is. So there's, you know, they have the mushroom cloud, sure. The radiation, it's bad, right? So there's a level of understanding, even if they might not know so much detail about it, they know that most people think nuclear weapons are bad. And actually consistent polling that we do shows that most people want to get rid of nuclear weapons. The lack of problem, I think, is that there's very little confidence in that we can do something about it. And I think that that is the biggest challenge. So for me, I think that, you know, I meet a lot of young people. I talk a lot I used to when we were able to travel and stuff, do a lot of lectures at universities or even high school sometimes. And I think that there is an interest, but there's just like, it feels very, you know, they just feel a little bit hopeless and demoralized about the prospects. And I think that's where ICAN comes in. And the work that we've done with the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons can also serve as inspiration and as, you know, building up people's confidence that this is not something for a DC think tank, men in suit with all the academic knowledge and PhD in nuclear physics. This is something that a regular person can speak about. Because there is this kind of the conversation about nuclear weapons is so kind of expert focused that it intentionally tries to discourage people from engaging. And I think we see that in a lot of other issues as well. It's like, well, what do you actually know? And look at the Fridays for Future and the climate change kids. Like, oh, you're just kids. You don't understand.
Right.
Like an intentional way to dismiss people, to make them feel like they don't have the right to talk about it. So I think once people get over that, it starts to get easy. But then, of course, I mean, there's no lack of issues to fight today. I mean, there's so many things that are happening that we need to tackle. So I also think we need to respect people's like limits in bandwidth. But that's why I also believe very much in these kind of organizations that work on it, that not everyone has to be on the barricades. Not everyone has to devote their lives, but you can also just support an organization, right? Like that it doesn't have to take a lot of time. You can just kind of like amplify them, maybe contribute with a little bit of a monthly donation, or maybe like retweet their tweets or just share those things. And that by kind of multiplying the impact of what someone who then has the staff that can do it full time can do.
Being a recent expat of the United States, let me hit the obvious questions here. How much did Donald Trump as president age you over the last 4 years, given the rhetoric, the immaturity, the lack of understanding of many political issues around the world, and probably nuclear weapons falls into that category? I mean, how much sleep did you lose knowing you could wake up one morning and Donald Trump just happened to, you know what, let's fire off those nuclear codes. Why not? You know, I mean, the whole back and forth with Kim Jong-un before they started exchanging flowery love letters and all. I mean, I can't imagine how somebody in your position went to sleep at night knowing that that situation was out there.
It's really funny that you say that, because actually there's been two moments, right, during his presidency where I was actually really scared. And I think the first one was with Kim Jong-un and North Korea, you know, when they had that extremely tense situation. And then that coupled with this false alarm in Hawaii.
Oh, where yes. People in
Hawaii, like, I mean, that was exactly at that moment, right? So had I been in Hawaii, then I would have taken it seriously. Like, you know, no, but seriously, because it was so tense at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously things move so fast, we've already forgotten about it, but that was terrifying for people. People hid their kids in sewers, right? Googling, like, what to do in a nuclear attack. And the fact that we're sort of living through that and, you know, it was so bizarre. And I was really, really worried there how quickly things can escalate. And the other thing was really his last week in office, you know, seeing the, you know, kind of him slowly losing his mind, like the disconnect from reality, having Nancy Pelosi, right, calling the military to try to get assurance that they would stage a coup if he tried to do it. I mean, because that's basically what she asked them.
Yeah.
That the military would disobey the orders of a democratically elected president. That's the definition of a coup. So I think that, you know, that was also extremely nerve-wracking. But I think that one of the most difficult things during these 4 years has also been the distraction it's been. Like the mental space and the energy that him and his comments, and you get very much sucked into it. And I think that also journalists probably have had it. It's like, does it say today, right? And then you get like the whole day is spent on responding or like explaining, and we're outraged and we tweet very angrily that this is the worst thing he's ever done. And then the next day, it's something else that they throw at you. And it makes you also forget that you have work to do, right? Like, so one of the things that I felt also kind of already in December when, you know, people moved on from the election, right? Like, you know, the election, yes, they were still contesting it, but most people agree that Biden is the president. It's going to be a new president. There was this like huge relief on not just because of him, but also like, I don't care what he says anymore. I don't have to respond to it. I don't have to think about it. Now, all of this energy we can spend on trying to make things better, right? Not spend the time being angry about what he just said and being out. Like, it's become this whole, like, thing that you've engaged in over the last 4 years. And I'm not going to lie, like, you know, some of it has been, you know, very beneficial for people against Trump, right? Like, it's been a marketing thing, right? Like, you say something, Trump is so bad, and you argue and you get lots of retweets and you get lots of attention. But it's like a, it's not a productive attention. It's not a productive result, and it doesn't lead us forward. So I'm quite excited now about having, you know, I don't agree with this precedent on nuclear weapons issue either, but I now have the mind space and the energy to push further and to look for progress rather than just trying to fight fires all the time.
In 2017, you put together this, you know, this treaty, and you get a bunch of nations to rally around it. The nine nuclear nations obviously don't. Their allies don't. And I would imagine during this time, you approach these nine nuclear nations. Were there any in those conversations that gave you the slightest inclination that they were open to the idea or gave you a sense that, yeah, we want to move away from nuclear weapons, but ... Try and give me a sense of what those conversations entail.
I think one of the things is important to separate like the different parts of government as well. You can have a government official who sits at the State Department or equivalent in other countries saying, absolutely not, never going to happen. But then you have senators and Congress people and parliamentarians who say, interesting, we're going to look at this. And yes, I'm going to work for this. And maybe I don't have a majority behind me in parliament here, but I'm going to work for this. So you have other institutions in the country that are like, oh, yeah, no, actually, we need to think about this. And that money could be used for other things that we see as a better priority at this point. So I do think that there's just, you know, sometimes we look at governments and it's like we only see the leader and think that that's all there is. But there is just so many different aspects of deciding what a country does. Like, it's not just one person. So I think that that gives me a lot of hope. And I think that that should also empower people to think about activism as, you know, you don't just have to go to the government and get an answer and that's it, right? Like, there's 100 different entry points and 100 different types of actors that somehow can shape and influence, maybe not the decision today, but the decision tomorrow and in the future. So I've had some incredible conversations with a lot of these people in different roles and on different levels and in different places in these countries, where it gives me, you know, confidence that, you know, also based on the past, we know that things will change eventually.
I like to try and be optimistic like that, but I see too many things that tell me no. United States, I mean, I could see a Parkland shooting, a Sandy Hook, and all these gun tragedies, and nothing changes. Mm-hmm. Nothing gets passed legislation-wise. So it's always difficult for me. I hate to sound like the pessimist to your optimism, but I always find it so difficult to be positive that there is going to be a change, because so much, and you know this as well as anybody, so many governments around the world are reactive as opposed to proactive, especially the major, you know, nuclear powers, the superpowers of the world. They're more reactive than they are proactive. It takes something happening for a change to take place. There always needs to be the disaster first. A 9/11 happens, then we decide we're going to make airports safer and you got to take off your shoes and you know, all these different things. So for me, it's hard sometimes to come around to the idea that, yeah, eventually there will be change and we'll get there.
I think you can see a lot of kind of things that have happened, right? And I think a lot of times when there's a moment that, you know, triggers change, we like to think of it as it was the moment that triggered change, but very often there's also movements prepared for that moment, right? So they've been mobilizing and rallying for decades in advance so they can utilize these moments. And I think that that's also something really important to think about. And I was just, you know, think about things, you know, we write history based on individuals, but change doesn't come through an individual person. But that's how we kind of describe things like MLK and Nelson Mandela. And we kind of dismiss the organizing and the groundwork. And I read this really interesting thing that people miss about, for example, Rosa Parks, right? Like the Montgomery bus strike, and people kind of, you know, she took this decision to sit down on the bus and that was it. I mean, she was a trained activist. She got a scholarship to go to an education that taught people different ways of disobedience. How do you protest against different things? And so, like, we only see that like one action, but right, there was a whole kind of set of people that organized and organized that course and organized those scholarships and paid for those scholarships that kind of led to these movements. So I think that, you know, sometimes in history writing, we're not very good at describing that or valuing that. But I also think that, you know, we sometimes forget about how much we have achieved and how much we have changed. And I think about things like, for example, in the United States, gay marriage, for example, something that no presidential candidate was in favor of, like, not even Obama the first time, right? Like, yeah, he would not go on the record and say that he wanted that. And then people just changed, and state by state and pop culture and, like, you know, the society just kind of like tumbled, and suddenly everyone is in favor of it, and nobody would like argue that they wouldn't be in favor of it. So it's also about the kind of building the pressure points on these politicians. Politicians don't lead. I mean, they reflect society. They will say no until it's not acceptable to say no, and they will have to say yes. So I can stay positive because I can sort of see how, you know, it's not really about convincing them. It was never about convincing the people who don't think that gay people should get married. It was about convincing all the other people that this is normal. This is the standard. This is that kind of stuff is unacceptable. And then you just kind of, you know, overwhelm them with that and just kind of raise the expectation and raise the norm in society that this is what's the new normal. Smoking ban, for example. You know, even when I was a teenager, like, it was normal to smoke in restaurants, and it's so unacceptable now. Yeah. Like, imagine just sitting in a restaurant and pulling up a cigarette or
sure.
indoors. Like, so weird, but we did it. And I remember how it was when the new law in Sweden came, and people were like, oh, that's going to be disastrous. People would never agree to that. People in France would never agree to that. And what do we see? Like, nobody, you know, smokes inside. So I think that the sort of shifts, and I'm not saying that it's the same kind of issues always, it's not, but I think that as a society, we also kind of underestimate the changes that have happened, and we kind of take them for granted. And we take that, like, well, that was just because it was time for that, or it was because of some other reason. But we kind of undervalue the fact that people were active and people made those things happen and people took decisions and put laws and put, you know, state by state laws and that kind of stuff to get it to happen. So I do think that change will happen on most things, and some things will for the worse, right? Like, it's just that continuing as status quo, that's also a decision people make.
In the hours leading up to our conversation, I saw that the U.S. and Russia extended the nuclear arms control treaty to 2026, which is obviously some measure of good news. Do you anticipate being able to have a conversation with the new administration, and how do you go about making that happen, and how long does it take to get on their radar given all the other things they have to work with right now?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's been a huge amount of activity from the administration already in things like climate change, in the WHO, you know, and we know that climate change and getting the pandemic sort of under control will be the two priorities. But I think it was a really good sign that just a week after the new administration in place, they extended this new treaty. I think that's a good sign. And I think it was good that it happened so early so that it doesn't get, you know, put forward as the big accomplishment, right? Like, week one, that's done. Now we have 4 years to do something more. because this kind of, you know, because I think it's also important for activists to put pressure. It's not enough just to not be Trump. Because Obama, he was great, but we got Trump after that, right? So we have to move forward and we have to kind of push the envelope. I know some of the people who are now taking over some of these roles in the State Department. And I think that they're bringing in like a lot of Obama's old team.
Yes.
A lot of very skillful like people.
Do you like that? Or would you have liked to have seen more new blood?
I think I think it's always like, it's important to kind of bring in new people for kind of new perspective. I think there's an importance to bring in younger people. It's important to bring more diverse people and from different backgrounds. But I think that they're doing a pretty good job. And I think that there's some good people in place. But I think also, like, you know, there are limits to what individuals in these positions can do. And what I see, and you know, this, the Biden administration is not going to support getting rid of nuclear weapons immediately the way we would like to. But I do see, of course, a lot more scope for engagement and having conversations. And, you know, from, you know, our strategy is also to, you know, push the limits of what is possible and to be sort of the advanced mission, right? Like, to, you have to ask for a lot, and activists have to be really radical in order to move politicians. Because I think that you can see that also on things like Black Lives Matter and the climate change campaigners, the Me Too, like, you know, if you charge ahead with activism, right, like the politicians have to catch up and they have to kind of move closer. And there's sometimes a sort of strong push to tell activists or to tell sort of NGOs that don't be so radical, settle for less, you have to compromise. But I think it's not our job to compromise, right? That's the politician's job. Like, they are the ones who will compromise. We will ask for all of it, and maybe we'll get half if we're lucky. So I think that's the way we want to approach this administration, that we can kind of, you know, increase the motivation and increase the scope where we can take this kind of action and where we can push them to take further steps. And sometimes that is by complaining and saying you're not doing enough. And it's tough love. It's not to kind of like applaud and say you're doing amazing, but to say you need to do more.
Beatrice Finn is the executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. She has been in that role since 2014, joins us here up late with Jason Page, also on the Intersection podcast. Couple of hotspots: Iran racing towards having weapons grade plutonium after Donald Trump took the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. 2 days ago, saw a headline in the Israel Times, I believe it was, said Iran could be 1 to 2 years away from having nukes. Does Joe Biden and this administration have enough time to put the genie back in the bottle at this point? And is Iran going to be a willing partner, given what the Trump administration did in pulling out of the last deal?
I mean, pulling out of the Iran deal was such a stupid thing to do. I mean, I can't explain that enough. It took so much effort to negotiate that deal. It was such a good deal. I mean, I think that Americans haven't fully appreciated how lucky they were that Iran agreed to that deal. Because according to international law, Iran is allowed to have nuclear energy up to this kind of standard. And other countries have it, right? So Iran is not unique. Other countries have much more advanced nuclear energy programs and are much closer to a nuclear bomb if they wanted to. But, you know, so the fact that Iran agreed to put that kind of limits, I think, was, you know, a huge victory for the Obama administration, a huge like victory for the world. And Trump really sabotaged that. I know that there's an intention from the administration to somehow try to fix this. And I think that's really good. I think it's important to remember that the capacity to build nuclear weapons is not like that unusual. North Korea is one of the poorest, least developed countries, and they managed. Like, so it's not really about the technical ability. A government who wants to have nuclear weapons will be able to at some point if they really, really want to. So it really has to be also with the, you know, making it politically difficult, making it sort of shameful. And that's where the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons comes in. Because one of the weaknesses in the U.S. approach is, of course, that the U.S. has nuclear weapons. And the U.S. government says, you need to have weapons of mass destruction in order to be safe. We are the biggest military power in the world. Nobody can match us. And we still need these weapons to feel safe at night. How are other countries supposed to be able to feel safe when they feel very threatened? So I think that there's you know, there's a need to work on you know, stigmatizing, making nuclear weapons not attractive, right? Like making it shameful in the way we don't think that chemical weapons is the solution to all our problems. Nobody wants to be seen as, oh, I'm a chemical weapons power. I'm at the big table like that. Oh, no, chemical weapons are awful. Like, why would you have them? We need to have the same type of process. And that's because chemical weapons are banned under international law. And now they are, nuclear weapons are as well. So we're hoping that the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, even without the nuclear armed states on board, will kind of kickstart this stigmatizing normative change that we talked about, you know, also with the same-sex marriage, like, you know, one by one, kind of making it less possible to accept to have nuclear weapons.
But is it a chicken or the egg sort of proposition in that, You mentioned the U.S. saying, well, we still need to protect ourselves. I can't ever imagine a scenario where the U.S. would get rid of them first in trying to encourage other nations. And conversely, I can't imagine other nations saying, well, the only country that's ever dropped an atomic bomb is the U.S., so we're not getting rid of them. So aren't we sort of at a stalemate in that regard?
Yeah, and I think that the way to get around that, right, is to lower the value of nuclear weapons so that it's, you know, and I think that is in many ways, I think is already happening, right? Like the military doesn't actually think that the nuclear weapons is that great. Like they are ginormous, clumsy, expensive radioactive bombs that create a whole lot of mess if you use them. And once you use them, like that's it. That's not a great situation to be in. They prefer precision guidance weapons. They prefer autonomous weapons, drones.
Drone strikes. Things that yes.
are, absolutely. And we're looking at a new kind of revolution in warfare with cyber warfare, you know, artificial intelligence in the military. We're going to a super high tech, completely different from the 1945s, let's wipe out a whole city with radioactive material. So I think that we're already seeing like the value of nuclear weapons in practical terms is a lot lower. Like it's much more about the symbolism behind it. The United States have the ability to carry out any kind of military mission on Earth without its nuclear weapons. It really does not need nuclear weapons. It has much more. I wouldn't say better because I'm kind of against all the weapons and stuff like that. But you know, more effective ways to carry out its military missions if you want to do that. So I think that we can get to a point where they are seen as clumsy, expensive, and a huge risk. Because I think that people also underestimate the risk of having nuclear weapons. Makes you extremely vulnerable to a nuclear attack by someone else in a way that being a non-nuclear weapon state isn't. There isn't a lot of nuclear threats towards Switzerland because we don't have nuclear weapons, right?
Right.
But countries, New York, Los Angeles, they're all targets of nuclear warheads around the world. And also accidents and miscalculations and just mistakes. There's been numerous of reports. Bill Perry, the Secretary of Defense under Clinton administration, has written a book about this. Eric Schlosser, investigative journalist, has written about this. So many near misses where we've been really close to nuclear war by accident. And eventually that luck will run out. So even if they don't use them by intention, there will be a nuclear detonation eventually. Just thinking about the risk and thinking about the number of warheads around, something will go wrong if we don't get rid of these.
We talked about Iran. You briefly mentioned North Korea. The Trump diehards would say, well, Trump kept them in check. No nuclear tests after Trump made nice with them. The love letters. Could it simply be that Pyongyang doesn't need to test anymore? You know, I read a former North Korean ambassador to Kuwait. It was in an Australian publication. Who basically said Kim Jong-un is never giving up his nuclear weapons, but might make a reduction if the U.S. decides to ease sanctions. How do we get off this hamster wheel with what is probably the most unpredictable and dangerous of all the regimes that owns nuclear weapons? I mean, how do you handle North Korea at this point? We've seen what every administration prior to Trump tried. We see what Trump tried. That didn't work. Where are we with this?
No, I mean, North Korea has nuclear weapons, right? So now it's a state with nuclear weapons. We have a precedent in terms of South Africa that had nuclear weapons during the apartheid regime and disarmed them and decided to disarm them. So it obviously can happen. There is a possibility. You can also see, you know, over time, there can be a democratic change. There can be a political change in North Korea and a country that a new leadership that wants to come in as a less of a pariah state and more of a welcome state. It can also be a peaceful solution to the Korean situation. You know, that people talk about unification of Korea eventually in the future. There's lots of scenarios. And what we do know, of course, and what we learned these last years is that we shouldn't be so clear on what could happen. Like things could happen that we didn't think was possible. So I think that that's definitely something that we should be open to. But I think it's really important to remember, right? Like that as long as we keep kind of saying that having nuclear weapons makes you powerful, having nuclear weapons makes you one of the important countries, you're creating this incentive. And I think you saw that. I was in Singapore for the summit between the Trump and Kim Jong-un, and you know, he was welcomed as a star. It was really, really bizarre how people's perceptions of Kim Jong-un changed with that summit. It was like he was his welcome party to the club.
It legitimized
one of the big ones now.
It legitimized him.
And it was extremely important. It was like devastating to see from like human rights perspective or democracy perspective, of course, one of the most awful regimes in the world being treated like that by a U.S. president. So I think that's extremely important. I think that what we need to do is really, and I think that that's where the treaty comes in into place that we're working on, like this kind of global effort, right, to not say having nuclear weapons makes you special and important, but having nuclear weapons makes you outside of international law. It's a bit like the human rights treaties, for example. We know that maybe Saudi Arabia is not going to follow them, but it sets the standard so that we can kind of criticize them. Every time you have, for example, I'm Swedish, like the Swedish government goes to China, right? They have to talk about human rights. They have to make it a thing. They have to have that part, and media is like, why aren't you complaining more about Chinese human rights issues? And it kind of creates that pressure on Sweden, for example. It creates that pressure on China, and it holds them accountable to a certain standard. And we've missed that on the nuclear weapons because we have this double standard that North Korean nuclear weapons are bad, American nuclear weapons are good. And I think that this treaty, right, tries to kind of increase the stigma around that and make sure that, you know, it becomes harder and more difficult, and also serves them as a non-proliferation effort, right? So Saudi Arabia, don't go there, right? Because there's a whole movement of the rest of the world that is saying that's unacceptable behavior. And that's hard. It's a bad behavior. You shouldn't be doing that. If you do that, we're going to like sit in the UN and complain about it. We're going to do that in bilateral meetings. Our trade agreements are going to be like part of that conversation. So yeah, that's really the power. We can't force governments to do anything, right? They will do what they want. So we can only create the kind of external pressure on them to shape their behavior.
In 2018, you had the opportunity, shortly after winning the Nobel Peace Prize with ICANN, you went to Nagasaki, Hiroshima, these places that were obliterated by atomic bombs. Try to harken back to that visit for a moment and give me the emotions and the experiences you had in speaking to people there about the devastation, because it's really the only case study we have of its kind to try and understand the destruction brought on by these weapons.
You know, it's extremely moving to be there and extremely sort of humbling to stand there at ground zero. And one of the things that you really get when you stand at that point in Hiroshima and in Nagasaki, and they have these monuments, right, to mark the venue, is that these are flourishing cities today. And I think that sometimes we talk about nuclear weapons almost as a computer game, in terms of if it happens, everything is over. There is nothing afterwards. And it's a little bit like an asteroid will come and hit Earth, and it becomes so destructive that there's no point in even thinking about it. And that's also part of what we talked about earlier, that it's too big almost for people to handle. But being there, you're realizing that there is life after nuclear war as well. And there are people who survive. It's a lot of pain and suffering. So it's not that it's all gone and we don't even have to bother about it. Somebody has to take care of the bodies. Somebody has to rebuild the cities again. And, you know, there's all these kind of items in the museums and pictures that just really hits you home that this is real. This is a real weapon. And talking to the survivors there, I mean, I think it was just like so incredible because they have been a very fundamental part of our campaign. In order to make that human connections, you need to hear stories. So they've been telling their stories and sharing, you know, the most traumatic experience you can have almost over and over again to protect people and to make people sort of realize that we have to stop this from happening again. And the kind of courage that these people have shown for 75 years now is really, really remarkable. And I think the world owes them a great deal. And I think that sometimes also we can get stuck on this. We haven't succeeded in eliminating nuclear weapons, so somehow we failed. But that's not true. I think that activists and the survivors and governments have prevented nuclear weapons from being used. If we had not done all of that work in mobilizing and during the Cold War, protesting and, you know, all these small treaties that together kind of create these like restraints on countries, without those things, there would have been nuclear war by now. Massive nuclear war.
Yeah.
You can't really prove it, but like I think that we have to also take for granted that things just will be fine if we don't do anything. People have been working to prevent it from happening. And I think the survivors in Hiroshima and Nagasaki have played such a huge role in that, to make sure that that doesn't happen again.
Having spoken to people after 9/11, having spoken to people in the police department, first responders, I lived in New York City for a number of years, and you see a certain look in their eye when they speak of 9/11, like they're almost back in that spot. When you talk to people in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, is there sort of that similar look that of people who survived this, who went through this, that look in their eye when they go back to that place mentally, that you can sort of describe in words?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think there's a point in, you know, when people share that kind of stories, is that they have to relive it again. And they place themselves there mentally in order to describe it. And I feel very much, you know, sometimes quite guilty. Like, we ask them to tell these stories over and over again. Go to this, you know, UN meeting and talk to governments and share your story. Go to this interview and talk to this story. At the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in Oslo,
yes,
we had Setsuko Thurlo being part of the accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. Go there in front of the whole world and tell this again. And she has to relive this over and over again. And you can really see that it takes a toll, and it's mentally and almost physically like exhausting to go back to that day and constantly relive this trauma. And I do know that it you know, you can understand how hard it must be to also move on from that kind of trauma when you are asked constantly to relive. So it is an enormous sacrifice that they are making, these survivors, to share these stories for other people to understand.
What is next for ICANN?
Well, now we have the treaty. It has entered into force. There is an international law that bans nuclear weapons. So the first step that we are doing is, of course, to make the treaty really effective. We're going to get more countries to join it. You know, each country, again, like this sort of game is chipping away, right? Like, each country will sort of build the norm and build the stigma around nuclear weapons. And we're going to kind of keep working on building more support there. So we're going to work on making sure that there's a really, really good, very progressive clause in the treaty about victim assistance, environmental remediation. This is a part of the treaty that is supposed to help victims and the environment of nuclear testing as well. And that, to me, is like such a useful thing, because even without the nuclear armed states on board, we can use this treaty to create measures to support Marshall Islands, Algeria, Kazakhstan, and all these places around the world that are devastated of nuclear testing, which means that, you know, we can actually use it to help real people. And real communities. So that's also something we're going to work on. And then I think it's you know, the public education, right? Like, to kind of use this treaty as the new basis for, in terms of like the Paris Agreement on climate change, right? This is the standard now. And now we're going to hold all these people accountable. We're going to go to, for example, we're not just focusing on countries. We're also focusing on things like banks. Banks are investing a huge amount of money in the companies that make nuclear weapons. But this is now illegal in international law, so they should get out. They should divest from these companies. So that's also something that we're trying to work on and kind of trying to get people to understand that it's not just the governments, right? It also is the companies and the banks and all these other institutions that could create change. So, yeah, there's a lot of work ahead of us.
Let me get you out on this one. We talked about the 4 years of Donald Trump and how that probably gave you some sleepless nights. We talked about the plan going forward for ICANN. What keeps you awake the most at night now? What's the greatest cause for sleepless nights, so to speak, for someone in your position?
I think the risk of an accident.
Interesting.
The fact that there are still, you know, there's these submarines that patrol the seas, loaded with loads of nuclear weapons. Each submarine carries like 7 times all the explosive of World War II. Like, one submarine, American nuclear submarine, carries that kind of explosive power. They can literally obliterate, like, you know, massive amount of cities in just a few, you know, with a few minutes notice only. And that something goes wrong. And I don't think that just like an accident where there's a, you know, there was two submarines, nuclear submarines that collided in the English Channel, a French and a British. Feels slightly unsafe. They've dropped nuclear bombs in the sea from planes, for example. There's been a lot of these things, but also now with technology, like the next wars are not, might not be fought in the way that all wars. It's going to be manipulation of public opinion. It's going to be manipulation of data. Can we trust the information? Can we, you know, hacking of infrastructure? We saw now in December hacking of US infrastructure, including the nuclear security kind of administration. And that just things very quickly escalate. And that there's an uncertainty and unpredictability that makes leaders take the decision to use nuclear weapons early, right? Like that we have no options and we don't know what's happening and there's all this kind of data coming in and all this information and we're not really understanding what's happening and it's unclear and push the button. I mean, it's not actually a button, but you know, that kind of thing really, really freaks me out. And in particularly coupled with this kind of feverish nationalism we've seen growing, the toxic masculinity about my button is bigger than yours, the kind of tone between some of the leaders. We saw crises between India and Pakistan, for example, between India and China, between the US and North Korea, like all of these kind of very tense moments where, you know, this kind of nationalistic tendency coupled with manipulation of data or maybe with hacking or knocking out key infrastructure can lead to something extremely dangerous. So that's something that I'm very worried about.
1984, I was 7 years old. I saw a British movie named Threads. I don't know how many seven-year-olds were watching a movie about a nuclear bomb hitting the UK in the aftermath, but I was 7 years old. It scared the bejesus out of me. Had nightmares after watching it. And this is something that stuck with me for 36 years and why this has always been a topic that is of great import to me. It's great to see somebody such as yourself taking this on with such a passion and vigor. I wish you the very best. You will always have a platform here with me if you ever need to get anything out. I very much appreciate you spending some time with me. Best of luck in the future.
Thank you very much.
Those are the thoughts of ICANN Executive Director Beatrice Finn, and that is all for this special edition of the Intersection Podcast. We're back with our regular episodes on Monday, always recapping five big stories from the week that was. If you haven't done so already, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you're on, Spotify, Apple Music, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, we're on all of them. And don't forget, check out Up Late with Jason Page. It's my new online video show. We go from 11 p.m. to midnight Eastern Monday through Friday. I'm Jason Page. Stay safe. Mask up. We'll catch you next time inside the Intersection Podcast from Believe.